Thank you. I don't know. Josiah says it's a really good message, so he hasn't heard it yet. I haven't even heard it yet, so we'll see where this goes. Maybe it'll be good, maybe it won't, but it's really a blessing to be here, and Josiah's talked about me pouring into his life, and it's funny that you say that. We've been spending a little more time together, and it feels like we're both pouring into each other's life. It's just really been a fun time to be able to spend time with you, and hear through you about Third Way, and I know just a few of you from here. Maybe some of you know me that I don't remember, but obviously I know Terry and Dave from a long time back, and just it's awesome to see you guys here. And Matt and Damaris, I think you said earlier, were the two originals from Third Way, the only two left from the original crew, maybe, something like that. I spoke probably 6 or 7 years ago. Seth had me come and speak at Third Way when it was in the apartment house, the discipleship house, up in the living room there. People were mostly sitting on the floor in a circle, and it was really fun. It was a great experience to be there, but it's been a long time. And so obviously new faces and a new venue here. And I was at the Covenant member meeting before this church service started. And one of the things that was stressed was how Third Way is experimenting with being a multi-voice community, multi-voice ministry. And that's, as I've just been sitting here experiencing this service, it's been absolutely multi-voice. I don't know how many different people have spoken in the 45 minutes that have been this service has been going on, and so I love what you guys are doing. It's really close to my heart. We're trying to cultivate our own version of a smaller scale church community, house churches, and multi-voice and missional. And so we're really excited about what is going on with Third Way, and that's fun to be sharing ideas back and forth with Josias. So as Josias mentioned, you guys have been in the Sermon on the Mount for a couple three months, and tonight, the message tonight is kind of a wrap-up of that. So Josias told me a while back that I would be speaking on Matthew 7, 13 through 29. And as I looked at this passage, I thought, well, this is really, it's not any new material. The Sermon on the Mount is just all this rich, amazing stuff. It's like Jesus' real heart, his vision, his passion. And this passage, it's not new material. It's kind of a summary of, well, now that you've heard all this great stuff, now what? Now what are you going to do with it? And so that's going to kind of be the main focus of how I unpack this. I'm going to put my phone up here because I need to watch the clock and make sure I don't keep you guys here until the 10 o'clock news. But so now that you've heard that this section starting in chapter 7, verse 13, it's really just Jesus now saying, well, I've unpacked what my kingdom vision is and what my calling to my disciples is. And now what are you going to do with it? Theologians would call this the hortatory section. It comes from our English word exhortation comes from this, where it's a challenge now. He's summed up what his vision is, and now he's challenging his disciples with, now what? Now what? Now that you've heard this, now what are you going to do with it? And so what I'd like to do is just take a couple seconds. You guys have been through this for the last few months, but the Sermon on the Mount is Jesus' summary, his manifesto. A manifesto is like a declaration of what Jesus is going to do. It's his vision and it's his plan, his master plan for his kingdom on earth. And so it's his most well-known, but probably his least practiced set of teachings, which is a sad thing. But we realize this since you guys have been through this in the last few months, it's challenging. It's challenging words. So it's very well-known, very appealing. Even non-Christians are drawn to the message of the Sermon on the Mount. But it's also challenging and hard to live. And so most well-known, least practiced. But what did he just say? So I'd like to hear just a couple high points from any of you who want to shout it out. What are some of the high points for you in this last 2 or 3 months from the Sermon on the Mount? Either something you remember from the sermon itself or a point that stood out when you've been hearing the messages on it. Does anybody want to share? Just pop up 2 or 3 thoughts. What stood out to you from Jesus' sermon in these last 2 months? Go ahead, don't be shy. I know you're not a shy group because you were talking a lot earlier. Yeah.
I really loved Terry's preaching on divorce and the discussion we had around that.
It's actually his sermon on divorce. I was the discussion.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But it was great.
Well,
that's multi-voice again. That's very perfect. Awesome. Anybody else have something that stood out to you from the last 2 to 3 months? Great. Yeah. So being invested, and then you leverage that relationality to be able to speak into and challenge each other. Excellent. I'll take one more. What's another thing that stood out to anybody? Yeah. Okay.
Was it the Bible thing?
Yeah, the glasses that flip the world upside down.
Yeah. Cool. Very cool. So it's revolutionary, but we're not living in, I mean, we're living in sort of a pseudo-reality, in a sense, in this world. But we're supposed to be bringing into this reality, this pseudo-reality, the reality of Jesus' revolutionary kingdom. It's a revolutionary kingdom. It's amazing, this opportunity we have. So just a summary, as I went through the Sermon on the Mount, just to kind of refresh my own memory on it, there's many different ways that you can break it down into what are the main points that Jesus is making in this sermon, or different commentators break it up into different ways. But the way I broke it up was Matthew 5, 1 through 16, it's about this upside down culture. It's the Beatitudes. It's flipping it upside down. It's saying, okay, the poor in our world aren't blessed, but in this kingdom of Jesus, they're blessed. The ones who mourn are blessed. The ones who are persecuted are blessed. And so these are things that we don't necessarily see in our kingdoms of the world around us, but it's an upside-down culture that Jesus sees and he calls us to help him create and enter into. Inside-out religion versus outside-in religion. Matthew 5, 17 to 48. It's about heart postures versus like legalistic rules, and Jesus flips religion on its head. The next one is sincere versus showy spirituality, Matthew 6, 1 through 18. There's all these religious practices that some of the Jews could engage in to be seen and to sort of get points with God or with others. And Jesus flips that on his head. He says, it's good to have religious practices, spiritual practices, prayer and giving, but do them for the right reason. Do them as a sincere expression of your love for God and for others instead of a showiness towards others. Living by faith, not by fear, Matthew 6, 19 through 7, 12. This one's about, you know, not storing up treasures on earth and hoarding money and not being anxious about tomorrow and chasing after all the things that all the others chase after. If we have an anchored heart in the love of God and his fatherhood and then his ability to provide for us, and we our security is anchored in God, then we can come into the world, we can navigate the world differently, we can navigate relationships differently. Jesus flips that on his head. So a lot of very revolutionary teachings and principles. And then Jesus wraps it all up in this section we're looking at tonight about two different pathways, two different gates, two different foundations, two different trees, two different fruits. We're going to be looking at that in a moment. So basically, as I just said, with the two different fruits, two different trees, pathways, etc. But we're going to start with the narrow way. I'm going to be reading some of the scripture passages here. So starting in verse 13, it says this, "Enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction. And there are many who enter through it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and there are few who find it." Now, a lot of times this passage is taken out of its context and it's used as a sort of a way to scare people into accepting Jesus as their Savior so they don't go to hell after they die. And there are eternal ramifications to Jesus and his gospel and his message, but mostly Jesus is talking about the here and now. He's mostly talking about ways of life right now that are either destructive to us or others, or life-giving for us and others. And Jesus is inviting us to enter into this kind of life, but he says it's a narrow gate and it's a narrow way, and there are few that find it. So basically, the first time Jesus uses the word narrow in this passage in the Greek, when he says enter through the narrow gate, he's literally talking that Greek word there is it's constricted. It's very, very narrow. It's hard to get through. It's constricted, literally a narrow gate. But then at the last part in verse 14, he says, the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life. And now he switches and he uses a different Greek word for narrow. And at this time, it's not the word for constricted and small. This word for narrow means it's full of trials and persecution and tribulation and affliction. So to follow this pathway, it's not just narrow because few are pursuing this pathway, but it's a very difficult pathway. And this is partly why a lot of people have appreciated and admired the words of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, but haven't necessarily actually lived them out because they're hard, they're difficult, they're challenging. We see pictures here of a wide gate and a narrow gate. Both of these are pictures of different gates in the old city of Jerusalem. One, as you can see, there's a lot of people taking that pathway. The wide gate implies it's easy, it's popular. Most people go this way. The narrow gate is much smaller. Very few people can get in and out. It's not as glamorous. And so Jesus is talking about two different pathways that lead to two different gates that lead to two different kinds of life on this other side of it. But the one that the narrow one leads to is one that's challenging. He's not hiding that from the front end. He's not a slick salesman who's trying to sell us something. He's really trying to almost talk us out of it or have us at least enter into this narrow way and this kind of life, knowing what we're in for. I'm going to use a little illustration about when narrow is good. A lot of times in our culture, narrow ways are considered like narrow-minded and bigoted or judgmental. But there's a time when narrow is good, right? If you're in Minnesota driving on a two-lane highway in the winter and it's snowing and sleeting, it's pretty good to stay on that narrow path, right? You don't want to slide off. If you're on a bridge, you know, it's pretty good to stay on that bridge rather than to slip off either side of the bridge, right? So sometimes narrow, we can understand, is really good and narrow is life-giving and healthy. I want to show you a picture of when narrow is good. My family had the opportunity this past summer, the trip of a lifetime. We were able to go to Norway as a family. And my daughter, who's now 19, she did some Googling before we went to Norway, and she said, well, we have to go to this one place. This place is called Trolltunga, which means the troll's tongue. It's a rock prominence that sticks out over a fjord. And isn't that beautiful? But it's like a 7.5 mile hike up and then a 7.5 mile hike down. But when you get out here, narrow is actually pretty good, right? So this is a place where you can see the obviousness of how life-giving a narrow way can be. You get a little too close to that edge or to that edge, and you know that's not a good thing. Even though it's beautiful, it's deadly. But narrow is good. A narrow pathway can be very life-giving if there's wisdom and truth and love in that pathway. I'm going to come back to that story of the Trolltunga hike in a little bit later. And obviously, then, this is the wide gate. That's if you saw a gate that said destruction on it, would you even consider going through it, even though it looks so easy and appealing and fancy? But Jesus is almost playing a game with us here, and he's kind of saying, you know, the gate's so wide, and yet the path is wide, and it's full of people, but it's a gate that leads to destruction. But it's not always evident. The gate doesn't say that it looks appealing. It doesn't say destruction on it. The ways of the world can be very appealing to us, and yet they often end in the way of death. So the reason that the way is narrow and that it's hardly traveled at all, it's the road less traveled, to use a quote from both Robert Frost and M. Scott Peck, it's because it's difficult. And there's one of my favorite quotes is from a British writer named G.K. Chesterton. And this narrow way that Jesus is talking about is like this. Christianity has not been tried and found wanting. What he means there, it's not been tried by a lot of people and found that it lacks in some way. Christianity has not been tried and found wanting. It's been found difficult and left untried. And I think this is just another way of saying what Jesus is up to here, where there's this wide pathway that looks good, but there's destruction on the other end of it. There's a very narrow path that's constricting and also full of affliction and persecution, but it actually leads to the most awesome possible kind of life, even with the trials. But it's a hard way, and because it's been hard and found difficult, it's often left untried. It's the road less traveled. It's the path not taken. So there's many ways because of this over the years that the Sermon on the Mount has been actually misinterpreted by good Christian people. Because the Sermon on the Mount, as you've been hearing for the last 2 months, is beautiful ideals that come at a high price tag and a high cost in terms of our living them out. And so over the years, many different people have tried to say, well, here's how we can sort of dismiss what Jesus is saying here. These awesome words that are so hard to live and they're so challenging and costly. Well, Jesus maybe didn't really mean them, or maybe they're not really for everybody. Here's how we can let ourselves off the hook for actually having to live out Jesus' teachings here. So the early church, on the one hand, they took Jesus at his word. They said, well, Jesus really meant these things. What he's doing here in his Sermon on the Mount is he's restating in his own words, and he's clarifying, and he's modeling the Mosaic Law, the heart of the Mosaic Law. He's not nullifying it. You guys heard in the sermon that Jesus says, I didn't come so that this would pass away. I came to fulfill that Mosaic Law, but fulfill it from the inside out at the heart level. So, and then he empowers us. He models it for us. He teaches it, and then he empowers us with his Spirit to actually live it. But unfortunately, so much of the church has written off the Sermon on the Mount and found all kinds of ways to say, well, Jesus couldn't have really meant that we were supposed to live these things. For example, I went the wrong way there. on this clicker. Going too far. One click. There we go. Augustine lived in the year 400 something or other, and he had a lot of great ideas and a lot of things, but he was a person who then said, well, you know what? The Sermon on the Mount is not really for everybody. The Sermon on the Mount could only really be lived by priests and monks. It's not really for the common people. So it's a higher sort of calling and a higher sort of standard for spiritual giants who are in ministry, etc. Luther, about 1,000 years later, a little more than 1,000 years after Augustine, comes along and does something very similar. He says, wow, this is an amazing sermon, amazing truths. He himself tried to live it out in a lot of ways, but he said, well, this isn't really for every area of life. He had this two realms theory where it said the Sermon on the Mount applies to our spiritual life, our sort of sacred life. So in our sacred dealings with other Christians and in church activities, we live this Sermon on the Mount out. But when it comes to our life in the world and our secular lives, at our job, at workplaces, etc., nobody could possibly live that out. So it's not really for the secular world, it's for the sacred life, two realms. And in order to let people off the hook for living it out. Dispensationalists, this is more of a modern phenomenon in the last 100 years, but there's a group of people that divide up the era of mankind, of history of mankind, into different dispensations. God works in different ways in different time periods. And they basically said that Jesus' Sermon on the Mount is not for this dispensation. It's for the millennial kingdom. When Jesus comes to physically and literally reign on the earth for 1,000 years, that's when the Sermon on the Mount applies. We don't really need to bother ourselves with it now. It's obviously undoable. So, but in the millennial kingdom, when Satan's locked up for 1,000 years, then it'll be possible, and Jesus will be with us, and somehow things will be different so that we could live it then. All different ways of letting ourselves off the hook to take Jesus seriously, and all ways of ignoring Jesus, essentially, or dismissing him. I'm going to read you a quote from one of my favorite preachers and authors, Brian Zahn. He pastors a church down in Missouri, and it's from a book called Beauty Will Save the World. I highly recommend this book. But he says this: we have tamed the Sermon on the Mount with a patronizing sentimentality, and being sentimental about Jesus is the religious way of ignoring Jesus. Being sentimental, what does that word mean? It means we kind of think, well, that's nice. That's a little idealistic, but that's kind of nice. But that's our way of religious way of being nice to Jesus, but actually dismissing him and dishonoring him. But what if Jesus really meant this stuff? What if he really meant those things that he wrote or that he said and that were recorded under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit? He did say that few would find it. And you can look at that one way and you can think, well, that means that it's not really doable. But on the other hand, actually, when Jesus said that few would find it, he said that a few would be able to find it and live it. He's actually implying that it is doable and livable. It's not impossible. It's not overly idealistic. When Jesus said this, he said that it was possible. It could be lived. It wouldn't be popular, but it is possible. And in fact, the people in the history of the world who have tried to live out the Sermon on the Mount have made a difference in the world. And we have a number of just big names who have... Each of these people on the screen here would point and say, the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' message, some of them not even Christian, at least Gandhi wasn't a Christian, but they believed Jesus and they took him at his word and they said, we're going to try and put this in practice in our real lives in the real world. And so you know Tolstoy is up there, Martin Luther King Jr., Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and Gandhi. Each one of these people went to the sermon and they looked at it and they said, what if Jesus really meant this? And it's the most beautiful kind of life possible. What if we actually put feet to it? What if we built communities around it? What if we showed up in the world as a community, like you guys right here, that actually manifests these things you've been hearing about for a couple months in St. Paul, in your workplaces, your neighborhoods, your families, in the way you do community together? It would create a revolution. It wouldn't be like a huge splash in the world. It wouldn't hit the evening news. But it would start a revolution as a mustard seed that would make a difference. And each of these guys found a way to live it out that did make a splash. And it did make the evening news, if you will, because they took it that seriously. We can do that as well. We're going to look at the next section, which is about the fruit, the two different trees and the two different fruits. And it says here, beware of the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You'll know them by their fruits. Grapes are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor figs from thistles, are they? So every good tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot produce bad fruit, nor can a bad tree produce good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. So then you will know them by their fruits. Again, I think sometimes this passage, as with many of them, is used like the trees being cut down and thrown into the fire. It's often used as a warning to scare people out of hell again. Okay, so obey Jesus, accept Jesus so you won't get thrown into hell. Again, Jesus is mostly talking in this sermon and most of his messages, even though there is eternal ramifications to everything Jesus teaches. In this sermon, he's mostly talking about this life and two different gates to enter into two different kinds of life now that will either be fruitful or unfruitful. Another way this particular section is used is about our individual fruitfulness. People say, well, am I one of the good trees that's producing good fruit? Are you one of the bad trees producing bad fruit? And there is a sense in other passages in Scripture that fruit is talked about, the fruit of the Spirit from Galatians 5, etc. We are to be fruitful and multiply the beauty of God's image throughout earth. But in this particular passage on trees and fruits, it's not really about our individual fruitfulness. Let's take a look at this a little bit closely. It says you, in verse 16, you will know them by their fruits. Who's the them? False prophets. This entire section here is not just about yours or my fruitfulness, even though character fruitfulness is important. This is a different kind of thing Jesus is getting at. He's trying to help us understand how will we discern between the true prophets and the false prophets. And what's the role of a prophet? A prophet's job is to point people onto a particular pathway. Or if you're a true prophet, you're going to point them on a pathway of truth. And that's what Jesus has been doing in the Sermon on the Mount. He's pointing to this particular pathway that leads to this gate, that leads to this kind of life. And false prophets will point people to a different pathway, to a different gate that leads to a different kind of life here and now on earth. And so prophets will either point the way of God or they'll lead people astray. And this is what Jesus is talking about in this passage. And so there are many people pointing to that very popular, wide, smooth, easy pathway. Many prophets, even in the Old Testament time, in Jesus' time, in our day, it's the same thing. Many prophets are pointing to this particular wide way. But we need to listen to a prophet's voice to find out what the true pathway is. And how will we know who the true prophet is? In effect, Jesus is claiming for himself that he is, he is the true fruitful prophet. In this section, he's saying, okay, you know what? There's lots of voices out there. I'm one of them. You'll know true and false prophets by their fruit. Who had more fruit than Jesus? Whose life was more consistent with his message than Jesus? Whose life was more beautiful and loving than the life of Jesus? He was the fruitful prophet. Jeremiah 6:13 is a passage from the Old Testament where the prophets were leading the people of Israel astray. And from the prophet even to the priest, everyone deals falsely. They, the false prophets, have healed the brokenness of my people superficially, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. So there were false prophets prophesying the broad and easy way, even in the Old Testament, which is part of what led the people of Israel to their destruction by being in exile. Isaiah 30, the same message. For this is a rebellious people, false sons who refuse to listen to the instruction of the Lord, who say to the seers or the prophets, you must not see visions. So the people are telling the prophets, hey, stop seeing those visions. We don't want to hear from God. They tell the prophets, you must not prophesy to us what's right, right? Speak to us pleasant words. Prophesy illusions. Speak to us about a broad, smooth, easy way that fits our agenda and it fits our schedule. Don't talk to us about this narrow way that's difficult and full of distress and it costs a lot. Don't talk to us about that. Give us these pleasant words. Prophesy illusions. True and false prophets. On that hike that we did this past summer, which my kids at the end of this hike, it was 9 hours. It was rainy and cold. And they all said at the end of it, this is the worst day of our life. But we saw, they did. We saw some amazingly beautiful things. If you ever had the chance to go to Norway, I strongly recommend. It's amazingly beautiful. But when we were on this hike, there were a lot of the time you were not clear where the path was. It was up in the fjord country and in open tundra, and most of the place was like this where you couldn't really see a pathway. And so we could be wandering for a long time and get lost and freeze to death out there if we didn't find our way to our destination back in the day. So in a place like this where the path is not evident and it's pretty wide open, you need prophets, so to speak. You need signposts to help you find your destination, the right destination. So if you, any of you have been hiking, I'm sure there's hikers in this group here. There must be some hikers, all right? So you know what a cairn is? Whoops, my little words. What's a cairn? It's right there. It's a pile of rocks. And they pile up rock piles along the trail so that you can still find the trail even though there's no evidence of footprints because it's all rock here. So you can't really see footpaths. So they pile up rocks to point you kind of the way. The trouble is, though, the people are kind of jokesters. And so we got up here, and there's cairns everywhere. You get up in these wide open places, you come around a curve, and then there's cairns, like, everywhere, like this picture shows you. Well, where am I supposed to go? I don't know. It's crazy, and there's not that many people up here, so we're not able to follow the crowd, so to speak. So the cairns are supposed to be the prophets that lead you safely on the right path, but now there's false cairns. A bunch of people putting piles of rock to lead people astray for the fun of it. But how do we know the true path and the false path? And so thankfully, the stewards of this particular trail in Norway would go along with red spray paint, and they would make sure the cairns that were the authentic ones had the red T on it. And for Trolltunga, the Trolltunga Trail. And this is how we were able to find our way. We found a lot of cairns that didn't have that marking, and then we'd say, where's the red? And you could always see the red because it's so bright. And the real trail's over here. And that's the function of prophets. This is who Jesus himself is. He's in a broad way that's not clear, and there could be easy ways to destruction and comfortable ways to destruction. There's a lot at stake. Jesus is saying, you know, look for the true prophet and you'll know them by their fruits. Listen to that person's voice. I'm going to skip that one. But in Deuteronomy 18:15, Moses himself points to Jesus. Moses, who was considered the prophet of the Old Testament, points to Jesus before his birth and says, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your own, from your countrymen. You shall listen to him. Listen to this prophet. He's the one who will point you to the right path, even though it's a hard path and it's a narrow path and it's a challenging path. Listen to him. Follow his ways. So Moses endorses Jesus, and Jesus says you'll know who's the true prophet by their fruit. And then this last section now, Jesus is saying, now that you've heard all of these things that the true prophet is speaking about, the narrow way as opposed to the broad way and gates, what are you going to do with it? It's about hearing and then doing instead of just saying. Let's look at this. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name cast out demons? And in your name perform many miracles? That's impressive stuff. Jesus says, well, I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. So Jesus is saying that there are people, it's easy to hear his message and to admire it, and then to say, Lord, to say the words, Lord, Lord, without actually living the reality, King, King. That word Lord actually means King, Master, Master. So many will say Lord, Lord, Master, Master, but they're not living it with their lives. They're not doing what Jesus has taught them to do. The key word for this whole section of Matthew 7:13 through 29, the key word in that section, according to expositors, is the word doing. The Greek word poeo, it appears 9 times, and it's so much focused on doing. As we said before, the first part of the Sermon on the Mount is all Jesus giving his truths, his vision, his principles, his teachings about this new upside-down kingdom. This last section now is about Jesus saying, are you going to do it? Are you going to hear and then do instead of just say or admire it? Hearing is for doing. A number of other passages in the New Testament remind us of the same theme that Jesus picks up here. Romans 2:13, it's not the hearers of the law who are just, but the doers who will be justified. James 1:22, prove yourselves to be doers of the word and not merely hearers that delude themselves. Luke 6:46, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? So the emphasis in the New Testament is on doing, not just hearing. We need to hear in order to do rightly, but ultimately hearing is worthless if it doesn't translate into doing. It's about living. It's about a life way, a pathway. And then finally, the last section for Jesus is about the solid rock. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine. Now, when I was a first brand new Jesus-following believer, I remember somebody preached a sermon. They were doing some exegesis in the New Testament, and he said, whenever you see a therefore, you need to know what it's there for. Yeah, you ever heard that one before? therefore. So whenever you see a therefore, you need to know what it's there for. In other words, the therefore is pointing back to everything Jesus just said in the whole Sermon on the Mount. I've said all this stuff. Therefore now, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew, slammed against the house, and yet it did not fall, for it had been founded on the rock. Everyone who hears these words and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew, and slammed against that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. Does this sound familiar? This, that little section of Jesus, what does that remind you of? Go way back to your three-year-old, four-year-old, the three little pigs, right? So Jesus was not telling us a little children's story. The creator of the three little pigs story really was taking the theme that Jesus is talking about and turning it into a children's story, but it's still very profound. Jesus is basically saying this. You remember the story? Three different pigs, they built three different kinds of houses. One made out of straw because it was easy and cheap. One made out of sticks because it was a little harder but still easy and still cheaper than the brick house. And then the smart brother or sister, whichever in the case this was, builds the brick house, takes the extra money and the time to build something enduring and lasting and solid. And sure enough, the wolf comes and blows down the other two houses, and then those two little pigs who weren't really thinking long-term or about the reality of this war zone world that we're in, their worlds collapse around them, and they come running into their brother's house for safety and security, and he welcomes them in, and they're safe against the wolf, right? Now, the story in our culture has been used about, you know, be industrious, be a good hard worker, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But Jesus' way of telling this story is be wise, follow the true prophet, live the narrow pathway to the narrow gate that life is on the other side. Two different ways of life based on two different prophets who are teaching. There are many different prophets over here and one particular prophet, Jesus, the fruitful prophet, teaching a way of life that's hard, but it will endure. It's the kind of life that will create a refuge in this kind of world. Not so we can just ride it out safely, but so that our lives can be available to others. Our homes can be available to others. Our church can be a house that's built on a rock that is a shelter in the storm for others. A lot at stake here in learning how to build our house on the rock, following the teaching of the true prophet Jesus, and living out the Sermon on the Mount. I'm going to skip over these passages. That's really great stuff, but we're running out of time. I'm going to give you one more quote from Brian Zahn on the church, and I'm going to give you this as an encouragement or exhortation. You guys have just been listening to the Sermon on the Mount for 3 months, 2 to 3 months. You're hearing a little wrap-up message on Matthew 7 right now. You guys, as a church, have the opportunity for your community to be like that third house, the house on the rock built of brick that is able to be a shelter in the storm and to be a place of refuge and a light, a city on a hill, and a place for others to find the ways of Jesus and the love of Jesus. Brian Zahn says this, a shelter from the storm is a beautiful metaphor of the church. It's not an angry church on a crusade for a political cause or a detached church disseminating dogma to a disinterested culture. Jesus tells us that if we will live this teaching, we will build a house on the rock-solid foundation that will stand when the rains fall, the winds blow, and the floods rise. To say it plainly, a church that lives the Sermon on the Mount will be a shelter from the storm. Do you guys want to be that kind of church? Do you want to be that kind of community? Do you want to be that kind of house? Do you want to offer that kind of place to the world around you, to this neighborhood in St. Paul, to the wider Twin Cities area? You have that opportunity. And here's where it all ends. Jesus says, therefore, everyone who hears these words and does them, ... The rest is up to you guys. Now what? Where will you go with this? Will you move on to the next series and forget about this stuff that you've just been hearing? Or will you move forward and start to build this kind of a community on the rock and be this kind of people, even though it's the hard and high-cost road? I'll be praying for you guys. I appreciate the offer to be here. Josias is going to come up and bring things to a close tonight. But it's been a pleasure to be with you, and I'm looking forward to hearing what you guys got going in the future.